Hello and welcome to A Journey into the Classical World, with in front of us the meditations of Marcus Aurelius, Roman Emperor in the 2nd century and philosopher. Indeed, in modern terminology, I suppose a diarist extraordinaire. This is brought to you by Everyman's Library, whose publication in English of the world's greatest books in hardback constitutes such a vast resource for every kind of reader. I'm James Naughtie, and to take us back to Roman times and the figure of Marcus Aurelius himself, I'm glad to be joined by Robin Lane Fox, who taught classics and ancient history at the University of Oxford for more than 40 years, now Emeritus Fellow of New College there. His new book on Hippocrates, called The Invention of Medicine, comes to us in September. Robin, hello.
Hello there.
Now, we need to begin with the figure of Marcus Aurelius himself. I mean, he became a very important figure in the Roman world, and he's left us, as we'll come to in a minute, this book of meditations, which speak to people now. But let's go back to his own time and remind people who he was, where he came from, and what he achieved.
Marcus Aurelius's upper-class family had been settlers in Spain, and Marcus Aurelius was born in the year 121, came to Rome, and he was adopted, aged 17, by the, in turn, adopted heir of the then emperor Hadrian. And his adopted father, Antoninus Pius, ruled as a good Roman emperor, steady, low-key, unpretentious, for 30 successful years, until really 161 AD, whereupon Marcus becomes nothing less than the Roman emperor on his adopted father's death. And he rules the Roman Empire for the next 20 years. Now, he had married in the 140s Faustina, whom he much appreciated, and I like to remember that they had no fewer than 13 children, imagine it, but only six of them lived, five of them daughters, and one who survived to inherit the empire was a disastrous playboy and psychopath called Commodus. So Marcus Aurelius becomes the Roman emperor and faces trouble on all fronts of the empire, invasions in the east, rumbles in Britain, bit of trouble in Spain, but most importantly, trouble from the Germanic tribes, who else, coming down from the area of the River Danube and threatening North Italy. And for much of his reign, is spent in army camps trying to combat the danger and problem of the movement and raids of these Germanic peoples. And it is there that he writes for himself, I'll come on to that, the world-famous book we call The Meditations, not in Rome, but in an army camp up near the River Danube.
It's fascinating to get that insight at the beginning of our conversation because, of course, it reminds us the vast scope of the Empire of Rome at that time, you know, how far it spread, the various influences, the tensions that inevitably brought. And we're talking now about a period which was really the beginning of the end of the glory of Rome, aren't we?
Well, some people might want to say so. Edward Gibbon regarded the rule of Marcus's adopted father as being the age of greatest happiness in the history of the empire. And indeed it was, if you were at the top of society. And Marcus faced serious problems, invasions by the Parthians in the east, and then these repeated invasions needing the recruitment of new legions, very expensive and resented, and a very modern problem. The army who had repelled the Parthians in the east had let loose and caught a plague, and this epidemic swept back into the Roman world. We don't know how many it killed. I mean, modern guesses would be perhaps 20% of the population, probably some of Marcus's children. And it was never properly, obviously, cured. He had to live with it. It might have been smallpox. So not of his own making. His reign is a very difficult time. But take heart, after the pandemic, the same world resumes, and the Roman Empire really continues for another 250 years. You can only say it's the beginning of the end with very long historical hindsight, which I'm wary of applying.
And from this character, written, as you say, away from Rome, we have the meditations that have rolled down the years and are still being read. Just to introduce us to this work, why do you think that it has proved so enduring that people, you know, in the 21st century still find this a place of wisdom when they read something like, I mean, in the translations vary, obviously, but the happiness of your life depends upon the quality of your thoughts. It's quite serious stuff. Why has it lasted?
Oh, yes. Well, I think there are two questions. What is it, which may help to explain why, in fact, it's lasted? And not everybody, I think, fully realizes. The meditations are just a subsequent title. And it is an extraordinary thing. We have absolutely nothing else like this from anyone in the Roman Empire, let alone a Roman emperor. It is his own personal diary jottings, often day after day, going over the principles of thought, action, and behavior. And he is writing for himself. He's not writing for posterity. He's not got an eye on future publication. Very, very different to most modern self-help literature. So the work has survived really through a secretary after his death, preserving it. It passed into a manuscript. And that may be one of the reasons why people are initially drawn to it. He is not lecturing us. He's not being bossy like someone in a pulpit. He is going over the principles of thought, action, and desire that are involved in following the Stoic philosophy. And extraordinarily, we are reading him daily, giving himself a sort of mental workout. I'd put it like this. During lockdown, many, many people have taken up Pilates and physical workout. I can see why. But Marcus would take up a mental workout. He would engage with the very demanding principles of Stoic ethics, logic, and natural philosophy, and try to live up to them. And I think with the fact that we are watching somebody intimately, setting himself standards and knowing that he's falling short makes it much more appealing than if he's bossily telling us how it all has to be. But there is a second thing. The meditations are most popular in extracts and little abbreviations. They had an enormous success, for instance, in Italy in the 1970s, in nice little booklets which people gave to their friends and their family, the wisdom and sayings of the Emperor Marcus, but they cut out the crucial setting of the principles of philosophy and thought, which make them quite difficult to understand in most of the books. They simplified them. So I would say we have this extraordinary chance of watching a Roman emperor, the most powerful man in the world, wrestling with his own thoughts, philosophy, and himself. We are looking in on that. And secondly, they are so popular because they can be excerpted and abbreviated into nice little snippets. I think if people try to read the whole book, they'll find that the first book is fascinating, where he thanks the 16, the great figures in his life, all the things he owes to his adopted father, his mother, his friends, his philosophy teachers, and ultimately at the end, the gods. Thanks for all the lessons I learned. That's quite easy, a little bit puzzling, but then you pitch from books 2 to 12 into often rather complicated technical terms of Stoic philosophy, and you can wonder between the famous sayings, what on earth is going on here? So we might come on to that and try to see if there's a way through the labyrinth.
Well, that's fascinating because it gets us to really the first question, which is, why did he write these meditations, these notes, these diaries? And you're saying that really they were for himself, not for others. It's a notion quite different from the way these things tend to be done in the modern world in terms of anyone putting on paper a diary, because that presupposes that it's going to be published. It's going to be, the bread is going to go out on the waters for other people to learn from or be amused by or whatever it is. Whereas for him, he was talking to himself, really.
Exactly. Among Roman emperors, Augustus wrote an autobiography, the first emperor. We've only got, sadly, tiny little bits of it. And of course, it's presenting himself as he wishes to be seen. And then we have the book I most hope that before I die we discover, the memoirs of the Emperor Nero's fearsome mother, Agrippina. I'm sure they were quite different. And yet, 100 years later, here is a Roman emperor wrestling with his reason, himself, and his predicament, and at quite a high abstract level. So, as you rightly say, people write now self-help books, and they publish them for others. And anyone who is interested in writing a diary has got an eye on the wider public. Not so at all in the case of Marcus's writings, which were initially entitled by a scribe to himself, not even a diary.
Why do you think he did it? Why did he commit these thoughts to, well, paper, let's call it that?
Well, I think he is doing it in his 50s. He has not been tremendously well. One of the reasons have been an uprising with a pretender in the East trying to challenge him as emperor. We're told is a belief that he was getting a little old and past it. That may not be wholly true, but he's writing in later age. And you find in books 2, 3, when you start reading them, there are many rather powerful meditations on death and its relative irrelevance. It'll come when it comes. This fits his time of life. But the reason he is writing is that in his 20s, when he's about 25, he had had the beginnings of a real conversion to philosophy. Now, this happens sometimes to well-placed young men. They would meet a philosophy teacher. They would give up excessive display, show, extravagance. They might grow a beard. They would live in quite a simple way on a hard bed. They didn't have to join a university department or write a book. Philosophy could be very much a choice of life. And Marcus has been profoundly impressed by the Stoic school of philosophy, which went back before him for nearly 500 years. And it's come to him, he tells us, partly through an important teacher with whom he sometimes quarreled, called Junius Rusticus. And Rusticus, very strikingly, is given very high office in Rome. Imagine it, the philosophy professor running New York just because he happened to have taught one of the American presidents. And there are quite a few philosophers in high positions in Marcus's reign. And Marcus has studied, we can see clearly, the teachings, which also have been taken down and survived from his pupils, of the earlier Stoic philosopher Epictetus. So the meditations are essentially going over principles that this Epictetus, about 50 years before, had taught his pupils. Now, Epictetus had been born in Asia Minor, in the town of Hierapolis, modern Pamukkale in Turkey, and he was born a slave. He came to Rome, was set free, and became a freedman. He was then expelled with other philosophers from Rome and went and set up on the northwest coast of Greece and gave sort of teaching lectures and sessions to pupils who were passing by. And I think Rusticus had been one of them, and took careful notes on the master's teaching. And we can see, as Marcus himself hints from time to time, that he is really struggling with Epictetus's principles, philosophy, and teaching. And from time to time, Marcus actually says, as Epictetus says. And when we compare what he writes with Epictetus the Stoic, we can see that it's not a work of original thought, the Meditations, but he's trying to live up to the system and principles and ethics that Epictetus had made famous in the upper classes, and particularly for some of the Romans.
And indeed, you find in the Meditations, and they're relatively short in the beautiful Everyman's Library edition. They run to just over 90 pages, so they're very sort of manageable for a reader. Mm. You come across things which hit you like a sort of minor thunderbolt. It's not death that a man should fear, but he should fear never beginning to live.
Yes.
Which gets to the heart of things.
It does, but it all has a relationship with a philosophical structure less familiar. The roots of it are three principles. The principle of judgment to the impressions that reach us from other words or events, what philosophers once called sense data. And we must strip them down to the bare minimum with no evaluation and then act on the minimalist statement. He refers to vintage wine as simply grape juice. Provided you see that it's grape juice, you will tend to react to it in a sensible way. Or even refers to sex and describes it memorably as the rubbing of two lower stomachs on each other with spasmodic giving off of fluid, reducing things to an absolute minimum. I mean, obviously, we think of it as being pleasure, affection, and love, not for Marcus. Then that has to influence the principle of desire. Should you want this in the total picture in which you're placed? That raises a lot of complex questions. Try to want what is the providential reason and order running in the world. And thirdly, the principle of action. And each of these principles he is copying out frequently in his later life in a setting that is as unphilosophical as you can imagine. A Roman army camp, either near Vienna or on the Danube or even beyond the Danube, when he's trying to chase off German barbaric tribes. And he's aware that his role as emperor has put him in a setting where his youthful love of philosophy is very hard to sustain. But every day and night, he's going over it, and in order to keep it alive in his mind.
You make the point there that for anyone who thinks that the lessons from two millennia before our own time aren't relevant, this book provides a wonderful antidote. There's a famous line which rendered in various ways, but a loose translation would be, the best revenge is not to be like your enemy. Now, we'll leave aside whether that would be good advice for the current president of the United States, but these things do spring out at us with extraordinary freshness. He was clearly a very clever man, a very sharp-witted man. I mean, somebody who was on his mettle the whole time.
Jim, he would be delighted to hear you say that. He says at one point, realize that you are not very quick-witted. Accept that. You have other attributes. You are self-controlled. You think and so on. Compared with a great philosopher like Zeno, the founder of the Stoics, he's not a sort of super double-first Harvard philosophy professor. But what he has is a wonderful turn of phrase and an ability for himself to put things memorably. At one point, he says, you know, obviously we must accept what befalls as it's for the best, and we must act proportionately to our role in the bigger picture. We must follow reason, not be swayed by pointless pleasure or inessentials. And he concludes, neither a tragic actor nor a tart. And what he means by that is, don't make a scene of life. And in his rather questionable view of a tart, don't just pursue temporary pleasures for the sake of money. There's much more you could say about being a tart in the Roman Empire, I'm sure. And you remember the phrase, neither a tragic actor nor a tart, for instance. You're absolutely right, but it's not that he's got a brilliant mind. He is derivative from Epictetus, but he has a brilliant turn of phrase, even writing for himself.
When were the Meditations, in a sense, rediscovered? When did people begin to sense that they had this wonderful resource which had lain, you know, unseen through what ludicrously people call the Dark Ages?
Well, that's a fascinating question. First of all, just remember the extraordinary thing. Here we have a self-styled philosopher, N.B., ruling the world. The only comparison I can find is Havel, briefly after the collapse of the Soviet Union, who wrote a book indeed called Summer Meditations. And even more fascinatingly, as he wrote it for himself, they disappeared. Nobody refers to them much. We have one other philosopher as a Roman emperor, the philosopher Julian, and try as I will, I can find not the slightest hint that he is aware of the Meditations. They're alluded to occasionally, but in the Byzantine world, they are clearly admired and studied in about the 10th century AD, and then as individual manuscripts of them, copied and copied by Byzantine scribes, that's in the East Greek world, In the 16th century, people become aware of the text and there are repeated attempts at translation. And there's been a sort of small fondness for the meditations on through into the 19th century. Then people became interested in a fascinating question. What is the difference between this sort of self-help ethics and Christianity? And of course, Marcus does coincide with very earliest Christianity. And then, as perhaps revealed religions and preaching slightly lost its hold in educated society, people rather felt they'd discovered an earlier alternative form of wisdom. And we now have an annual Stoic Day. There are people who call themselves Neo-Stoics. And I would say that actually the meditation's clientele now is bigger than it's ever been. But it didn't make an impact in antiquity. It really wasn't alluded to much. And really only from the 17th century onwards does it make much impact in modern culture. And I would just add, it's made absolutely no impact in most classical syllabuses, even in my beloved Oxford. It was never, ever mentioned to us because Roman history stopped a little earlier and started a little later. And it's something I only discovered later, having taken my degree. And I think that's true in almost every department.
That's a fascinating insight. Why did the study of classics, you know, let's say over the last 150 years, not find this precious resource tumbling down? What was it?
Well, I think there were a cluster of things. First, classical philosophy concentrated quite rightly on the great philosophical minds, Plato, Aristotle, and then more latterly, some of the Stoics and Skeptics. Marcus is a great describer of principles he's trying to live up to. He's not a great thinker, so he wasn't going to make a mark there. Secondly, there was a view I emphatically don't share that later classical works were somehow in decline. They didn't have, and indeed, they don't have the real power of the geniuses of Homer and the great Athenian tragedians of the 5th century BC, and his Greek was a bit odd. So it didn't get studied there. And then on the history front, there was always the admirable tradition of studying ancient history from original sources and historians writing in detail about the period. And the problem was that for Marcus's decades, there isn't any contemporary historian writing reliably about what's going on. So he didn't really suit that agenda either. And also, Stoicism was studied in the 1st century AD as a sort of a philosophy of grin and bear it under the likes of Nero and so forth. And people didn't really bother to follow the later strand of it. And so it really is an independent study by the ethically minded who have made more and more of Marcus Aurelius. But specialists in Marcus are very few and far between.
What you're saying really is that the magic of, you know, these 90 pages or so is that they synthesize so much. They're not pretending to be original. They weren't written for publication, as you say. They were simply a matter of personal thought and, in some ways, struggle, but also a lot of humor, a lot of searching for insight. But in that sense, they are so precious because they're not part of the great sort of public tradition of whether it was oratory, philosophy, whatever it was. This was somebody who had absorbed all this stuff and somehow managed to put it into a form that, you know, 2 millennia later, we can still read with profit and fascination.
I think there's truth in that, but actually I would just qualify your interesting word synthesis. It's basically his understanding of Epictetus, but I come back to the crucial point. We are watching uniquely somebody going through mental exercises and workouts, repeating the principles which he is trying to live by. Now, Stoics, including Epictetus, used to say, you must copy out the basic principles every day and remember them always in your life. And so this is what Marcus is doing. It's not really the meditations, it's mental workouts. And that really is most unusual.
He says at one point, if it's not right, don't do it. If it's not true, don't say it. Goodness, that's rather a good epigram for all our lives.
It is, but you have to see it in the context of these three principles of assent, desire, and action. And you'll find that what is right is not always as broadly defined as we would. There is one dimension I'd like to stress to Marcus. People sometimes think the Stoic is rather a chilly, egocentric figure who's concerned only with his own stability and surviving when everything is falling to pieces around him. That is really not true. The actions to which we should assent are actions that interrelate with a similar fact, something we all appreciate, that we are fellow humans with others who share divine reason and the providential order of the world. It is not just selfish narcissism. And I would emphasize that the principle, love your neighbors, is already there and put pretty much in those words by Marcus without having to be found only in Christianity.
To use a very loose translation, he says somewhere that there is a rule to remember for the future when something tempts you to feel bitter. And he says something like this: that is misfortune, but to bear it worthily is good fortune. Not a bad way to approach life.
No, I mean, all of that is excellent, but it relies on a further setting. I think we have to be clear that is actually completely untrue. Marcus, like the Stoics and many at the time, thought that through the world runs a principle of divine reason, which has arranged everything for the best, and including showing a sort of providence for individuals. Think of it like the force in a seed, if I could take a comparison with gardening. Things are going to develop into cucumbers because seeds necessarily become cucumbers. Reason runs through all the matter and extra parts of the world, and they develop the way they do because that's how reason thinks they should develop. Well, we want to be clear here. This whole dimension, which is fundamental to the idea of judgment, desire, and action, is completely false. It's been killed once and for all by Darwin and evolution. Modern Stoics try to abandon it and say, oh, he's just saying you must face up to the facts. But that is adopting Stoicism for nowadays. He's just plain wrong. And secondly, it is a very, very difficult argument that whatever happens is for the best. There will be some things that are, in his phrase, necessary accessories, like a pandemic, like plagues of locusts, like a famine. You shouldn't be thrown or too disturbed by that. And also that the social order, as we know it, is simply designed by Providence and is for the best. In no way is Marcus, as a philosopher, inclined to challenge the social order of the Roman Empire, which highly favored the upper classes and concentrated power in the hands of one man, the emperor. For him, that was the way it was by destiny. And it was for him to live his role as the emperor as best he could. Well, that's very different to activism nowadays, trying to make the world a better place, trying to find a cure. None of this is a primary concern for a Stoic.
What did he mean when he said something like the object of life isn't to be on the side of the majority, but to avoid being in the ranks of the insane?
He takes the view that though we are in fact all possessors of the divine universal reason, most people, in my view, thank God, are entirely oblivious of this fact. They ignore it. They love going to football matches. They make love in the grass. They have a wonderful time and they have great pleasure in completely inessential things. And according to Marcus, they're like people asleep. And so they are the majority. And the wise man who has woken up to the central role of divine reason in the human makeup and in the world will pay no attention to them. And he simply doesn't care what they will say. His judgment, his desire and action will run in accordance with that higher principle. Well, I simply don't believe it. I mean, views, for instance, what many people have of life, pack in as much as you can. That's completely not Marcus. It's lovely to have pleasure sometimes. Irrelevant, Marcus would say. I don't take those views.
Let me ask you this. Clearly, you adore this character because his meditations have come down to us, sort of by accident, rediscovered and been burnished and have a new life in our time. but what would he have been like to spend an evening with?
What a completely fascinating question. In one point, he says, accept that there are people who will indeed welcome your death. They will be glad that a teacher is gone from them and someone who always seems reproachful. We don't know. But I do just wonder if some of those around him find him really impossible and with a feeling they were always falling short. Look, if you're governing the world, you have to take rapid decisions. Of course, a lot of them turn out to be wrong decisions. That's in the nature of history. And to have somebody always there who is rather disapproving and focusing on a sort of protective attitude to chance, pleasure, and accident, I think it rather annoyed them. Marcus was very concerned to be truthful, to be just within his own idea of proportionate justice, justice according to your social position. He was very concerned to be fair, not to be extravagant, and to work hard. All of this very attractive, but it might have been rather a bore.
And, of course, he would be astonished, would he not, to realise that in the 21st century, people were revisiting these words, looking at the book and saying, what wisdom can we draw from this?
I think you'd be absolutely amazed. Of course, I think you'd be rather encouraged that the Stoic philosophy, essentially Epictetus, had found a second life. But I think my overriding point to people is do try to read it all and read it together with a little book about Stoicism and Stoic ethics, so that you don't just treat it as little sort of cracker mottos and nice little wise sayings, wonderful though they are to excerpt. Try to get the whole coherent picture of the natural universe. Logic is more difficult, but they had views on it, and ethics and action and desire that they have. And try to see it as a whole, because that is the way that Marcus is writing about it. And he's writing to keep himself up to the mark. And he probably did quite a good job. He's not vindictive. He's not madly suspicious of all the courtiers around him. He tries not to be a tyrant. And he tries to behave like a free and responsible person. You know, he was certainly doing his best. But in very, very difficult and demanding times, you can't be a philosopher and run the world.
A good man?
Yes, but there is one major, major question. He had all these high, fine principles. Look at his son. Only one survived, Commodus, and he marked him out as the future emperor. And Commodus is a massive psychopath. I mean, he is truly absolutely awful. His idea of amusing himself is fighting against wild animals and killing them in the arena by scores. He admires gladiators. He compares himself with Hercules. He threatens to cut the heads off anyone who opposes him. In the list of bad emperors, I mean, he even has outstripped Nero in the race to the bottom. So I think you have to say that, though fascinatingly, Marcus is fully appreciative of what he's learned from his adoptive father, Commodus learned absolutely nothing from his father. Is he a reaction to all the morality and all the relentless goodness and humility and self-analysis of Marcus in private? I rather think so. I think Commodus simply couldn't bear it and cut over the traces. So one thing Marcus does not take credit for is parenting and also legacy. He gives the world an absolutely shocking air.
Thank you, Robin Lane Fox, for taking us into the meditations of Marcus Aurelius and perhaps introducing, who knows, some new readers to this endlessly refreshing work. I'm James Naughtie, and this has been a podcast from Everyman's Library, the greatest hardback collection in English of the world's greatest books. Thank you for listening. Until next time, goodbye.